Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Story 1. Working in a psychiatric hospital isn't what most people imagine. It isn't just padded rooms and shouting patients. It's long hallways that never seem bright enough, doors that slam a little too loudly, and the constant hum of tension in the air. You learn to live with that hum. You learn to tell yourself that the unease is normal, part of the job, nothing to worry about. That was how I handled it during my 5 years there, until one night when all the background fear became very real. The patient had been admitted not long before. She was quiet for the most part, kept to herself, barely spoke a word. But she had this unnerving way of watching people, not in anger or confusion, just watching as though everyone else was part of some show and she was the only one who understood the ending. She'd been brought in because she swallowed objects, things that made no sense, forks, coins, scraps of glass, anything she could get her hands on. This time, she'd landed in surgery because she'd managed to get something lodged so deep inside that it threatened her life. They opened her up, removed it, and stitched her back together. A couple of days after her surgery, I was doing rounds down the hall when a scream cut through the quiet. It wasn't the usual type of noise we heard in the wards. It was sharp, panicked, the kind that made the hair on your neck rise. A nurse shouted for help, and I ran, not sure what I'd find. When I entered the room, I froze. The woman was sitting upright in bed, perfectly calm, her posture almost unnatural. Her hospital gown was torn, but she didn't seem to notice. She sat there composed, as though she'd been waiting for us. What unsettled me wasn't what she was doing, but the look on her face. It wasn't pain, it wasn't fear, it was irritation, like we had barged in uninvited. The nurse rushed forward, frantic, trying to get her under control. I stood in the doorway, unable to move. My body wanted to collapse, my chest tightening with the kind of dread that makes you want to flee. The room felt colder than the rest of the hallway, shadows pooling in the corners as if they'd thickened just for this moment. The woman's eyes locked onto mine. They didn't blink, didn't soften, didn't acknowledge me as a person. It was like staring into something hollow but aware, like she was letting me glimpse something that wasn't supposed to be seen. They sedated her quickly. But the image of that moment never left me. It wasn't the scene itself, it was her stillness. The way she carried herself as if the body she lived in didn't matter, as if she was just borrowing it for something else. I started noticing smaller things after that night. Walking down the halls, I would sometimes hear a faint scratching against the walls, like fingernails dragging along the plaster. But when I checked the rooms, everyone was asleep. Once I swore I saw her standing in the middle of the hallway at 3 a.m., but when I blinked, she was gone, and her door was locked like it had never been opened. Another time, I found blood smeared across the inside of a window, even though none of the patients in that wing had any injuries. Maybe my mind was breaking down under the stress. Maybe I was jumping at shadows, but I couldn't shake the sense that whatever lived inside her that night was more than sickness. The hospital walls seemed to hold it, echo it, as if the building itself wanted to remind me. I lasted only a few more months after that incident before I quit. People asked me why, and I told them the truth. I couldn't take it anymore, but I never told them the part that kept me up at night, the part where her bloodied hands held her own body like a doll, and her eyes never wavered, never softened, never showed even the faintest flicker of being human. Sometimes, late at night, I wonder if she even felt alive in the same way the rest of us do, or if something else was staring through her when she looked at me. I'll never forget it. Story 2. Working in pediatric mental health is like walking into a house where all the doors are locked, but you know someone is moving around inside. You never know what you're about to face until it's standing right in front of you. Most of the time, it's tough cases with kids who've been through trauma or have conditions that make daily life impossible. But every once in a while, there's one patient that doesn't just unsettle you. They stick to your memory like a shadow you can't get rid of. For me, that kid showed up one cold night, and I've never stopped thinking about him. He came in after the police brought him from home. He couldn't have been older than 11, maybe 12 at the most. He looked like any other quiet, withdrawn boy. Small frame, pale skin, hair hanging over his eyes. If you didn't know better, you'd think he was shy. But the file the officers handed us told a very different story. It was packed with reports of neighborhood pets turning up mutilated, cats stripped of fur and left on fences, dogs lured with food and then cut open with shards of glass hidden in the kibble. The kinds of things that make even seasoned staff look at each other in silence. The part that made it worse was that these weren't accidents or impulsive outbursts. The reports described them as planned. He'd stalk animals, corner them, and then carry out what he later called experiments. The neighborhood already knew something was off, but nobody stepped in until it escalated to something far darker. According to his parents, everything boiled over late one night. They had been asleep when they woke to the sound of heavy fabric being punctured. At first, they thought something had fallen, but then the bed jerked violently. When they turned on the lamp, they saw their son standing over them, gripping what they later described as a cleaver-sized kitchen knife. He had buried the blade straight into the mattress, lodged directly between where they had been lying. They scrambled up, half in shock, demanding to know what he was doing. He just stood there, calm, looking down at the blade sticking up from the bed. When they pressed him for an answer, he told them he had wanted to know if their insides looked like the neighbor's cat, the same cat he had pinned to a fence weeks before. That statement was why the police didn't hesitate to bring him in, and that's how he ended up under our watch. The first time I saw him, he was sitting in the intake room, swinging his legs back and forth like any bored kid waiting for a doctor's appointment. But there was something off about the way his eyes moved. They didn't wander like a restless child's usually would. They fixed on things, staff name tags, the keys clipped to belts, even the pens in our hands, and stayed there, like he was studying tools, not people. He never fidgeted, never seemed nervous. He looked at us like we were insects pinned under glass. In the first week, staff noticed small things. Birds would land outside on the windowsill near the ward. But when this kid sat near the glass, they wouldn't stay long. They'd scatter almost instantly, like they could sense something was wrong. At night, when most of the kids were asleep, he stayed awake, staring at the ceiling. If you passed by during rounds, you'd catch his eyes tracking you from the corner of the room without him moving his head. Nobody wanted to linger near his door. One evening during group recreation, he was given crayons and paper like the other kids. Most children draw superheroes, houses, or stick figures. He drew a perfect outline of a cleaver, blade, and handles shaded in neat detail. The paper pressed so hard it nearly tore through. When asked about it, he said nothing. He just slid the paper to the edge of the table and looked at the staff member until she turned away. The strangest moment for me came during a night shift. The ward was quiet, lights dimmed, only the hum of the ventilation system filling the halls. I walked past his room and saw him sitting upright in bed, completely still. At first, I thought he was asleep with his eyes open, but then he tilted his head slightly, like he was listening to something just behind me. I checked the hallway, empty. No noise, no movement. When I looked back at him, he was still staring, head tilted, lips moving just barely, as though whispering to himself. I never heard what he said. I didn't want to. There were other moments, too. The lights in the hallway flickered more often when he was around, though the maintenance crew insisted the wiring was fine. Kids in nearby rooms started waking up with nightmares, crying that someone had been watching them, though no one had ever entered their rooms. It could have been stress, or maybe they'd heard the rumors circulating among staff. Still, there was an unease that settled over the ward whenever he was awake. I've seen aggression before. I've seen kids lash out, scream, and throw things, but he was different. He never yelled, never fought back. Everything he did was deliberate, quiet. That made it worse. You can predict anger. You can't predict silence. He stayed with us for a few weeks before being transferred to a more secure facility. The day he left, he walked between two officers without resistance, his hands cuffed, his eyes fixed on the floor. But when he reached the exit, he paused and looked back at us. Not at the group of us, but directly at me, like he knew I'd been the one watching him most closely. For just a second, His lips curved into the faintest smile, and then he was gone. To this day, I don't know if what I experienced with him was purely psychological or if there was something else behind it. Maybe he was just a kid with severe mental illness and a lack of empathy. Or maybe there was something darker at work, something that made animals flee and lights flicker, and people feel like they were being studied from the inside out. I'll never be able to say for sure. What I do know is that in all my years working this job, no one else has ever unsettled me the way that kid did. He was more than scary. He was a reminder that sometimes the worst monsters don't come from nightmares. They can be sitting right in front of you, legs swinging, looking like any other child. Story 3. Hospitals have a way of swallowing sound, like thick walls and white tiles are designed to eat up every noise before it reaches your ears. When I did work experience there, I noticed it right away. Footsteps muffled, conversations cut short by doors. The kind of silence that feels like it's waiting for something. I thought I'd be placed somewhere boring, maybe paperwork or shadowing a general doctor. Instead, I got sent to the adolescent psychiatric ward. Half a day didn't sound like much, but it ended up being the most unsettling experience I've ever had. The ward itself looked ordinary enough, but there was a weight in the air that made every hallway feel longer than it was. Kids sat slouched in chairs, some staring at the floor, some talking to themselves, some just lost in their own heads. The doctor I was shadowing tried to explain things as we walked, but I could barely focus on the words. I kept noticing the atmosphere, the way the fluorescent lights hummed too loudly, the way doors had extra locks, the way the staff always seemed tense, like they were bracing for something. That's when I saw him. He was in a separate room, thin as a stick, lying on his side with a tube taped to his face. I was told he had been refusing food for weeks. The tube was the only thing keeping him alive. I'd expected him to look weak, maybe tired, but instead there was this sharpness in his eyes. They locked on me the moment I entered, like he'd been waiting. It wasn't the blank stare I'd seen from the other kids. His eyes were alive in the worst way, filled with something I couldn't quite name. The closest word I can think of is hatred. The nurse whispered that he despised everyone for keeping him alive. He wanted to die, and every bite of liquid being pushed through that tube was torture to him. He didn't fight physically anymore. He didn't have the strength. But the way he looked at you made you feel like you were the one trapped, not him. It was this burning, hollow rage, like he'd already decided everyone in the room had stolen something from him. At first, I thought I was imagining it, but when the doctor leaned in to check his chart, the boy's gaze slid past him and landed back on me. He didn't blink. It was like he was trying to burn a hole through me. I shifted in place, pretending to look around the room, but every time I glanced back, his eyes were still there, wide open, following me. It felt deliberate, like he wanted me to know he saw me and hated me. The longer I stood there, the colder the room seemed to get. My skin prickled, and the hum of the lights faded into the background until the only thing I could focus on was the sound of that feeding pump, a steady mechanical rhythm pushing liquid through the tube into his body. Each click of the machine seemed to echo in my head, in time with his stare. Something strange happened then, something I still can't explain. As I watched, the pump seemed to falter, slowing down for just a second before clicking back to its normal pace. The doctor didn't react, so maybe it was nothing. But in that instant, I swear the boy's expression shifted. His lips twitched, the faintest trace of a smile. It wasn't joy, it was more like triumph, as if he'd made it happen just by willing it. I remember stepping back, trying to shake off the thought. Machines glitch all the time. I told myself it was a coincidence, but the timing was too perfect, and the way his eyes lit up made it feel intentional. When we left the room, I asked one of the nurses quietly what his deal was. She just said he wanted to die and hated everyone for stopping him. She looked tired when she said it, like she'd explained it too many times before. But the way she avoided my eyes made me wonder if she felt it too. That unsettling heaviness that clung to him, the way he made you feel watched even after you left. For the rest of the shift, I couldn't stop thinking about him. Every time I passed a reflective surface, glass, polished tile, I half expected to see his face staring back at me. And more than once, I swore I heard that pump's clicking sound echo in my ears, even though I wasn't anywhere near his room. When my time on the ward ended, I walked out feeling relieved but shaken. I told myself I'd forget about it eventually, that it was just one of those intense experiences you file away as part of growing up. But I haven't forgotten. That boy's eyes still come back to me in dreams sometimes, sharp and alive, fixed on me like I'd stolen something from him too. It's easy to explain away the weird parts. Maybe the machine faltered because of a loose wire. Maybe his expression was just my brain playing tricks. Maybe I was so nervous that I imagined things that weren't there. But even now, years later, I can't fully convince myself it was nothing. Because in that moment, standing there in that quiet room with the smell of antiseptic in the air, it felt like he wasn't just looking at me. It felt like he was trying to reach me. And I'll never forget the way his eyes promised that if he could, he would. Story 4. Hospitals already carry a heavy atmosphere, but psych wards are different. The moment those doors lock behind you, the air feels like it has weight, like every breath has to be dragged in through a filter of old fear. I've been in and out of those wards more times than I'd like to admit, so I'm used to the routine. Check-in, paperwork, vitals, the standard process. Usually it's slow and clinical. But one stay in particular began with something I'll never forget. I had barely stepped onto the ward. 30 seconds in, maybe less, they sat me down to take vitals, cuff around my arm, pulse clip on my finger, when the entire hallway erupted with a sound so raw, it didn't seem human at first. A man bellowed a single word over and over again, his voice thundering down the corridor. It wasn't just loud, it was the kind of volume that rattles in your chest, like someone is screaming through you instead of around you. Heads turned instantly, staff stiffened, and before I could even ask what was happening, he appeared. This man was huge, easily the size of a linebacker, shoulders so broad he seemed to fill the hallway. His face was red, veins bulging, spit flying with every shout. He charged down the corridor like something unchained, stopping inches from one of the nurses. She was tiny compared to him, barely reaching his chest, and she froze in place with her back against the wall. What came out of his mouth made the moment worse. He screamed at her that her eyes were his, that he owned them, and that she couldn't take them back. His words didn't make sense, but the rage behind them did. His entire body was trembling with it, his fists clenched like he could crush anything he touched. For a second, I thought he was going to strike her right there. The hallway had gone so quiet except for his shouting. Even the other patients seemed to shrink back, pressing against walls and door frames. Then something unexpected happened. One of the patients, someone who looked frail and older, the kind of man you'd expect to be quiet and keep to himself, stepped forward. He put himself between the nurse and the raging man, standing firm even though he was half the size. That moment felt impossible. It was like watching a rabbit step in front of a wolf, but the larger man froze, glaring down at him, breathing like a bull. Time dragged in that silence. My pulse was hammering so hard in my ears I could barely hear anything else. Then the staff finally made their move. A couple of techs approached from behind, and with practiced speed, they pinned him enough to jab a needle into his side. The fight drained almost instantly, his massive frame crumpling into their arms. They guided him to the ground as his voice trailed off into nothing but a low mumble. That night I lay awake in my room, thinking about the way he'd shouted, the way he'd spoken about owning her eyes. It didn't sound like anger alone. It sounded like obsession, like possession, like something had gripped him beyond reason. I told myself it was just psychosis, just another patient with demons I couldn't understand. But that didn't explain the way the air itself seemed to vibrate when he screamed. The next night, it happened again, almost the exact same thing. Out of nowhere, his voice exploded through the halls, the same word repeated until the walls seemed to echo with it. He ran, fast and furious, and staff scrambled to contain him. He went after another nurse this time, spitting the same bizarre claims about eyes, about ownership, about how they were his to take. The staff reacted quicker this time, but the intensity hadn't changed. It was like he lived in a loop, repeating the same nightmare no matter how many shots they gave him. By the third night, no one was surprised when he started again. It was like waiting for a storm to roll through. You knew it was coming, you just didn't know when the first crack of thunder would split the silence. The newer patients would jump when he began, but the rest of us had already started bracing ourselves before bedtime. Some people even whispered that it wasn't just him, that something about the ward fed it. That night, though, things escalated. Instead of stopping at screaming in someone's face, he lashed out. A patient sitting quietly in the common room became his target. Without warning, he lunged and wrapped his hands around the guy's throat. The sound of chairs scraping, people yelling, and bodies colliding filled the ward. It took three staff members to drag him off, and by the time they did, the man he attacked was coughing and gasping for air. The big guy was finally transferred after that, taken to a more secure unit, where they said the walls and doors could actually contain him. After he left, the ward felt lighter, but the echo of him stayed. The place seemed scarred by his presence, like he had burned something into the air. People kept talking about him for days, some shaking their heads at how dangerous he was, others whispering theories that went beyond illness. A few swore his voice never came from just him, that when he screamed, you could hear something layered beneath it, like two voices fighting through the same throat. I can't prove any of that. Maybe it was nothing more than sickness, a man's mind twisting into violence, and nothing supernatural about it. But even now, when I remember him towering over that nurse and shouting that he owned her eyes, I feel the same chill I felt that first night. It wasn't just a man in rage. It was something else, something that made the air too heavy to breathe. I've been back to the ward since, different stays for different reasons, but I've never seen anyone like him again. The staff don't talk about him anymore. It's like they've shut that chapter and moved on. But I haven't. When I think about him, I wonder if it was just illness, or if maybe, just maybe, he carried something darker with him, something that wasn't his alone. Story 5. Working in a psychiatric hospital doesn't feel like a job after a while. It feels like living in a world with its own rules, where you're constantly teetering between the human and the inhuman. I've seen things in there that would make most people gag, and after nearly a decade, I honestly thought I was numb to it. But there's one patient I'll never forget. The one who made me realize that some things you see will cling to your skin no matter how many showers you take. He wasn't the loudest or most aggressive patient. In fact, if you passed him in the hallway, you wouldn't think much of him. He didn't shout obscenities or try to attack staff. What made him terrifying wasn't what came out of his mouth. It was what he did to himself. He had this compulsion, this awful ritual, where he would dig into himself, into places no human should willingly touch. It was like he didn't even belong to his body. He would push past the point of pain like it didn't exist, as if the signals that tell the rest of us to stop were missing from him completely. The night that burned into my memory started like any other. I was finishing paperwork when I heard one of my coworkers screaming for help. I bolted toward the patient's room, my stomach already sinking, because screams in this place never mean something simple. When I got there, the sight that greeted me was something out of a nightmare. The man was lying in bed, completely unclothed, and there was something wrong about the way his body looked. The sheets were stained with blood, his skin streaked with marks that didn't belong, as though he'd been clawing at himself in places no one should. For a moment I thought someone had attacked him, but my coworker, pale and shaking, told me she had just caught him in the middle of one of his compulsions. When I stepped closer, the air felt heavy, and a strange stillness filled the room, like the silence before a storm. He didn't flinch, didn't look ashamed, didn't even act like anything unusual had happened. His eyes were glassy, locked on some corner of the ceiling, as if he was listening to something we couldn't hear. It wasn't pain or fear on his face. It was calm. Too calm. The nurse told me to get him to the shower, but when we tried to move him, the air seemed to thicken. The floor felt damp beneath my shoes, though I couldn't see from what. My coworker and I glanced at each other, both unsettled by the way he walked, as if nothing was wrong, leaving faint marks on the floor behind him. What unsettled me the most was how his body seemed untouched by what we had just witnessed. There should have been more signs of harm, but there weren't. Only the atmosphere of wrongness that clung to him. It felt like the kind of thing you couldn't clean off, no matter how much water you used. He sat calmly on the towel while we waited for the ambulance, silent, staring ahead. The more I looked at him, the more convinced I became that he wasn't truly with us in that moment. He was somewhere else entirely, somewhere dark. When the paramedics finally arrived, they moved quickly, avoiding his eyes, and for good reason. There was something in that gaze that didn't belong to him. Over the years, I've seen plenty of disgusting things in that hospital, things that would make people gag just hearing about them. But that patient wasn't just disgusting. He was wrong in a way that didn't make sense. There was something inhuman about the way he could destroy himself without hesitation. The way pain seemed like it belonged to someone else, not him. Sometimes when I think about it too long, I wonder if there was more to it than just illness. The way he acted, it almost felt ritualistic, like he was offering pieces of himself to something we couldn't see. Every time I walked past his room after that, I caught myself holding my breath, like the walls might breathe back. Maybe it was just trauma and compulsion, maybe it was just his condition, but maybe, just maybe, it was something darker that kept him digging, something none of us could name. 8 years in that place has left me jaded, sure, but that patient? He's the reason I know some things will never leave me, no matter how many years pass. Story 6. Hospitals at night feel like places cut off from the rest of the world, and psychiatric hospitals take that feeling and multiply it. During my 2-month internship in a forensic facility in Germany, I learned that quickly. The place was split into two distinct parts. One held the acute patients, the ones screaming, hallucinating, sometimes violent, the ones who came in fresh from a psychotic break or a bad drug trip gone wrong. They didn't usually stay long. Once they were stabilized, most were transferred to less extreme hospitals. The other part, where I was assigned, was different. That section held the long-term patients, the ones who weren't ever expected to be released. They weren't loud or erratic like the acute cases. By then, years of heavy medication had dulled their edges. They were quieter, calmer, often sluggish. A lot of them were sex offenders, pedophiles mainly. With their libido suppressed by medication, they spent their days in a kind of haze, more pitiable than dangerous. Most of my time there was boring, if I'm being honest. Endless routines, paperwork, watching people shuffle slowly through the hallways. But one night near the end of my internship, something happened that I still can't explain. It was during a night shift, the kind that already makes your nerves buzz a little because of how silent and isolated everything feels. Our office was the only way in or out of the ward, built with thick security doors, cameras, alarms, the works. Two of my colleagues were making their rounds to check on the patients, so I stayed behind in the office to monitor the surveillance feeds. That was standard procedure. At first, nothing seemed unusual. The cameras showed the hallways empty, the rooms quiet. But after a while, I got this odd sensation, like someone was watching me. I shrugged it off at first, but it didn't fade. It got sharper, like a prickling across my skin. I shifted in my chair and glanced toward the window that reflected part of the office back at me. That's when my stomach dropped. In the reflection behind the doorframe, I saw the shape of a woman. She wasn't just standing there. She was half hidden, peeking around the edge of the door. And she was smiling, wide, fixed, like she knew something I didn't. For a split second, I thought maybe I was imagining it, but the reflection didn't change. She was still there, staring at me. I jumped up so fast my chair clattered against the wall. My first instinct was to hit the alarm on my pager, which would call my colleagues back immediately. My heart was racing so hard it drowned out every other sound in the room. I kept my eyes fixed on the reflection, but when I spun around to look directly at the door, no one was there. The hallway outside was empty. When my colleagues came rushing back, I told them what I'd seen. We checked the entire office in the hall, and that's when I realized I recognized her. She was one of the patients from the long-term wing, someone who had been there for years without incident. She was considered one of the quiet ones, heavily medicated, never violent, barely even responsive most of the time. The idea that she had somehow slipped past the cameras, through the locked doors, and into our office didn't make sense. But I knew what I saw. We escorted her back to her room. She didn't resist, didn't speak, just walked calmly as if nothing strange had happened. Her expression was blank again, not at all like the smile I'd seen. That made it worse somehow. Like the version of her I'd seen behind the door wasn't the same as the one shuffling back to her bed. Afterward, we tried to figure out how it had happened. The cameras covered every hallway, every door, and none of them showed her leaving her room or approaching the office. We rewound the footage again and again, and there was simply nothing there. She was in her bed the whole time, on video at least, but I had seen her standing there in the reflection, grinning like she had been waiting for me to notice her. It was close to the end of my internship, so I didn't have time to dig deeper. But even now, years later, I can't shake the image of her face from my mind. That smile didn't belong in a hospital. It didn't belong on someone doped up on years of medication. It felt wrong, almost inhuman. I tell myself there must be an explanation. Maybe stress from night shifts, maybe exhaustion playing tricks on me. Maybe I saw a trick of the light and my brain filled in the rest. But deep down, I don't really believe that. The memory is too sharp, too vivid. What unsettles me most is the thought that if the cameras never caught her leaving, maybe she never really did. Maybe she never moved at all, and I was staring at something that wasn't supposed to be there. Story 7. Working in a psychiatric hospital always felt like walking into a storm that never quite broke. The hallways carried this heavy silence most of the time, but underneath it, there was an edge, like the air itself knew something volatile was waiting to surface. I spent around 4 years on different wards, and though I met hundreds of patients, one stuck with me in a way that I've never been able to shake. Not because of her age or even her history, but because of the way she blurred the line between unstable and dangerous. She was only 17 when she was admitted. At that age, she should have been worrying about finishing school, friends, maybe a part-time job somewhere. Instead, she came in with a file thick enough to rival some of the older long-term patients. She wasn't just struggling with suicidal thoughts. She carried this constant, simmering rage toward everyone around her. Staff, patients, anyone who crossed her path seemed to trigger something in her, like she wanted to destroy anything living within reach. Even seasoned nurses admitted that she unsettled them. The first time I saw her, she was pacing in the corner of the common room, muttering under her breath. Every so often, she would stop and fix her eyes on whoever had wandered too close. It wasn't just a glare. It was the kind of stare that made your skin crawl, like she was working out the quickest way to hurt you. Other patients avoided her, which said a lot. Psychiatric wards weren't exactly filled with timid people, but even the ones who usually liked stirring trouble gave her a wide berth. There were little incidents that piled up quickly. A nurse found her trying to pry open a ceiling vent with a piece of broken plastic she'd hidden. She smashed a mug during mealtime and pressed the jagged edge against her own neck, laughing while staff rushed in to restrain her. Another time, she scratched another patient's face so badly it required stitches, and she showed no regret, only irritation that she'd been pulled off so quickly. Still, nothing rattled me the way one particular day did. It started like any other shift, checking rounds, supervising the day room, helping with meds. She had been given phone time, sitting off to the side with the receiver pressed tightly against her ear. Normally, she shouted during calls, swearing at whoever was unlucky enough to be on the other end. But this time, she was quieter. Focused. A little too focused. I wasn't paying much attention until another patient came up to me, pale and wide-eyed, whispering that they'd overheard her saying something about a pact. I moved closer, keeping out of sight but listening just enough. My stomach dropped when I pieced it together. She was talking to her boyfriend. They were planning to kill themselves. But the part that froze me wasn't the mention of death. It was how. She told him to bring her pet black widow spider into the hospital during his next visit. She said she would let it bite her first, then him, and then they'd set it loose in the ward. I've never been good with spiders. Even a harmless one can make my skin crawl. But the thought of a black widow being smuggled into a psychiatric hospital full of vulnerable people? That was on another level. The idea of her opening a container and releasing it into the common room made my chest tighten. I imagined it vanishing into some corner, impossible to track, while everyone sat there oblivious. When staff confronted her, she didn't deny it. She smiled like it amused her that we'd overheard. She said something about how poetic it would be for death to crawl out of a little box and choose who it wanted. It wasn't just talk, either. She had written instructions in her notebook, planning how they'd make it happen. Her boyfriend had apparently agreed. It felt like one of those moments you'd see in a bad horror movie, except this was real life, and I was standing a few feet away from the girl who wanted to weaponize a spider. We had to put her on constant watch after that, and visits were restricted. Security checked everything that came in, down to the smallest package. But even with the precautions, I couldn't shake the unease. I started noticing her staring at me more often, like she knew I'd been the one to report what was overheard. When I walked past her door at night, I sometimes caught her whispering in the dark, though I couldn't make out the words. It didn't sound like talking to herself. It sounded like reciting something over and over, like a chant. That's when the odd things began happening around her room. Staff found tiny holes scratched into the paint along the wall near her bed, like she had been digging for something. On another night, the orderly on duty swore he saw a dark shape scuttle under her door, but when they opened it, there was nothing inside. He insisted it looked like a spider the size of his hand, though no one else believed him. The cleaners complained that her window was always covered in webs, even when they had just scrubbed it clean. They thought maybe she was tearing tissues into strands and sticking them there herself, but the pattern looked too natural, too intricate. I kept telling myself it was just her reputation feeding into paranoia. People knew what she'd threatened, so now every shadow or speck on the wall felt like confirmation. But deep down, I wasn't sure. Every time I checked her room, I expected to see something crawling across the sheets. The worst night for me came when I was assigned to the observation shift. I sat outside her door, glancing in every few minutes. Around 3 a.m., I swore I saw movement across her ceiling. I blinked hard, thinking it was just my eyes adjusting to the dim light, but the shape was still there, shifting slowly along the corner where the walls met. It was too big to be dust, too solid to be a trick of the light. My heart pounded so hard I thought it would echo down the hall. When I opened the door, the ceiling was empty. She was lying on her bed, awake, smiling at me. That smile is what haunted me most. It wasn't playful or mocking. It was calm, like she knew something I didn't, like she was waiting. She eventually transferred to a more secure facility, and I never saw her again. No one ever confirmed whether her boyfriend actually had that spider or if it was all a manipulation to scare us. But the way those little things lined up, the webs, the shadows, the whispers, it felt like the threat never really left. Even now, years later, if I see a spider in my own house, no matter how small, I freeze. Because I always remember her words about letting death crawl out of a box. And I remember the way she smiled in the dark, as if she'd already set it free. Story 8. Working in a psych ward isn't what most people imagine. It isn't always screaming patients or padded rooms. Most days are a routine of meds, group therapy, and keeping people safe from themselves and others. But now and then, you get a patient who sticks in your memory long after you've left the job. For me, there's one man who always comes to mind, and not for reasons anyone would want. He wasn't big or particularly threatening at first glance. Average build, quiet face, the kind of person you'd probably walk past on the street without a second thought. But there was something about him that never sat right. He had this constant urge to break the rules of his own safety, like his mind was locked on finding ways to test the limits of what his body could endure. No matter how bare his room was, no matter what we took away, he always seemed to find some small thing to misuse, as if proving that nothing could stop him. What unsettled staff the most wasn't the behavior itself, but how deliberate it all was. He had a way of turning his own harm into a kind of performance. If he felt ignored, if he thought no one was paying him enough attention, he would stage something disturbing in front of you, calmly, methodically, making sure every eye was on him. It wasn't impulsive, it was calculated. I remember once, after a minor medical procedure, everyone had been extra careful with him, checking in often, making sure he stayed distracted. For a while, he seemed fine. Then out of nowhere, he began pulling at the edge of his gown, staring at the staff nearby with this strange, locked-in look. There wasn't shouting, no chaos, just a slow, deliberate movement that carried a heavy weight of dread. He didn't appear angry or panicked. Instead, there was this unsettling sense of satisfaction, like he wanted us to witness the fact that we couldn't control him. That was what made him frightening, not the injury itself, but the unpredictability. You could empty his room down to a mattress and four walls, and somehow he would still find a way to unsettle everyone. He didn't lash out at others, but the way he waited for an audience before acting made you feel like you were part of something you didn't agree to. It was as if the staff weren't there to help him, but to watch him prove, over and over, that he was in charge of his own destruction. Other patients gave him space. Even those who usually clung to each other in the day room avoided sitting near him. A few muttered things I won't repeat, saying he was cursed or that something was wrong with his spirit. I didn't put much stock into that kind of talk, but I'll admit the air around him was heavy. You could feel it in your chest, like the pressure before a storm. There were nights when I'd be doing rounds and I'd catch him staring through the glass of his door, not moving, just watching. His eyes didn't blink the way most people do. He'd stand there, face barely visible in the dim light, and it felt like he was waiting for me to come closer. Sometimes when I did, I'd notice faint scratches on his arms, new ones that hadn't been there earlier. We had no idea how he made them. His nails were clipped short, he had no sharp objects, nothing. Yet the scratches kept appearing. Once, after he'd been moved to a different ward temporarily, I had to help clean out his old room. When I pulled the mattress away from the wall, I found tiny rolled bits of paper hidden in the seams. Notepaper scraps, toilet paper, even gum wrappers. Each piece tightly twisted like he'd been saving them. I threw them out fast, but the thought that he had been building a stash right under our noses made my skin crawl. The creepiest incident, though, happened on a night shift. It was quiet, most patients asleep, when the alarms went off from his room. I rushed in, expecting to see blood or some kind of injury. Instead, he was standing in the middle of the floor, grinning. His gown was soaked, but not with blood, with water. He had somehow ripped open the sink pipe under the tiny bathroom basin and flooded half the room. He just stood there barefoot, water spreading around him, watching us like he'd been waiting for the reaction. When security pulled him out, he didn't fight. He just laughed under his breath, a sound so low it barely registered as laughter, more like a hum. The whole thing felt staged, like he'd been building toward it. The sink damage, the water, the waiting, it all had that same calculated feel as the way he tore his stitches. It wasn't random. It was a performance, and we were his unwilling audience. People asked later if I thought he was possessed, cursed, or just deeply disturbed. Honestly, I don't know. The medical side of me says he was desperate for attention, willing to do anything to make sure he wasn't invisible. But the part of me that stood in that flooded room, watching him smile in the dim emergency lights, can't shake the feeling that something else was working through him. I left that job years ago, but I've never forgotten him. Every so often, I wonder where he ended up, if he's still alive, if someone else is now walking into his room at night and finding him standing there, waiting to be noticed. Story 9. Working in a psychiatric hospital never felt the way movies made it look. There weren't constant screams echoing through the halls or wild patients thrashing around every corner. Most of the time, it was routine, scheduled meds, monitoring, charting, and trying to keep people calm in their own heads. But underneath all that order was an undercurrent you could feel if you paid attention, like walking on a frozen lake and knowing the ice was thinner in certain spots. That unease always came from the patients who never really spoke. There was one man who stood out more than the rest. He'd been there longer than most of the staff had worked, admitted with severe schizophrenia. He didn't lash out, didn't scream, didn't argue. He simply stood there, day after day. He'd be in the same place, staring into nothing, his body stiff, his expression vacant. He never responded when spoken to. He had to be fed, cleaned, and moved like a piece of furniture. He wasn't violent, but there was something unsettling about how absent he seemed. It was like caring for a body while the person inside had left years ago. Most employees stopped noticing him after a while. He blended into the background, like a shadow in the hallway that never shifted. But his silence lingered. It created this unspoken rule. No one liked being alone with him for too long. Something about his stillness made people uneasy. One day, my dad's friend, who had been working there for a few years, was helping out in the cafeteria. The place was usually loud with trays clattering and staff trying to guide patients into some kind of order. On that day, though, things turned chaotic fast. A patient suddenly erupted in anger, flipping a chair and shouting nonsense that rose to an animal-like growl. Everyone scrambled. The staff tried to calm him, but it escalated quickly, and they had to call in the orderlies. My dad's friend ended up near the wall, close to the emergency call button, trying not to get caught in the chaos. And right beside him stood the silent, schizophrenic man. Same as always, expression blank, eyes fixed on nothing, posture stiff. The shouting grew louder, and my dad's friend admitted later that he could feel his pulse hammering in his throat. He was shaking, breathing heavily, his fingers twitching near the call button. And that's when it happened. The silent man, the one who never spoke, the one no one had ever heard form a single sentence, moved his lips and quietly spoke. He didn't look at anyone. His body didn't shift. But out of the silence came a low murmur. He said that my dad's friend was scared, not in a questioning way, not in a casual observation. It was said with an eerie certainty, like he had been inside his head the whole time and decided that was the right moment to speak. My dad's friend froze. He swore the room fell quiet for a second, even though he knew the shouting was still going on. The words felt heavier than they should have, almost too sharp coming from a man who hadn't spoken in years. He couldn't even bring himself to turn and look at him directly. The only thought in his mind was that the patient knew, not by watching or guessing, but by somehow reaching in and feeling it. The orderlies came in a moment later and restrained the outburst, and everything settled back into the usual storm of noise and movement. But for my dad's friend, the cafeteria felt colder after that. He said it was one of the most unnerving moments he'd ever had in the hospital. No one else heard the words. It was quiet, barely more than a whisper. He couldn't shake the idea that maybe he had imagined it. Maybe the stress of the moment twisted things in his head. But then again, it didn't feel imagined. He described it as clear, simple, undeniable. The strangest part? That was the only time the silent man ever spoke. No one heard another word from him after that day. He went back to his usual stillness, staring off into space, being cared for like he was just a shell. But now for my dad's friend, every time he saw him standing there, it was different. He couldn't walk past him without remembering those words. He often wondered if the man had picked that exact moment for a reason. Maybe he had been capable of more all along and just chose not to show it. Or maybe in that one second, he'd connected to something that wasn't supposed to be possible. Even now, years later, my dad's friend swears it was the most chilling encounter he ever had in the hospital. Not the violent patients, not the screaming, but the quiet man who never spoke, breaking his silence with words that cut straight through him. Story 10. Working in a locked state facility wasn't exactly a job I imagined myself doing when I was younger. The kind of quiet where your mind notices every flicker of the fluorescent lights and the way the air feels heavy with disinfectant. I took the job to gain experience before grad school, thinking it would look good on my resume, but also because I wanted to understand what working in this environment was really like. For the most part, the patients needed stabilization, people off their meds, people in crisis. That was the whole purpose of the hospital, but every unit carried stories about that one patient you had to watch out for, and I learned quickly that those warnings weren't given lightly. It was about a month ago when I was assigned to a night shift on the schizophrenia unit. Before the shift started, staff gave me the usual rundown. What stood out, though, was the mention of a specific patient on the wing. They said he didn't sleep at night, ever, and he had a history of going after male staff members. I couldn't help glancing down at myself. I'm not a big guy, 5'6", about 140 pounds. Not exactly someone who would intimidate a person prone to violence. The staff member who briefed me said he was a burly man. Not huge, but solid. The type who looked like he'd grown up working with his hands. I remember thinking to myself, if he decided to come at me, there wasn't much I could do. When I stepped out onto the unit, it had that odd late-night atmosphere where everything feels just a slightly off. The halls were too long, the lights buzzed too loud, and every sound carried like it was echoing. That's when I saw him for the first time. He emerged from his room like he had been waiting for me, just standing there in the doorway. He wasn't taller than me by much, maybe 5'8", but he had a stocky frame that made him look heavier and stronger. I tried to keep calm, introduced myself, and explained that I'd be on rounds for the night. He just stared at me for a moment, then started speaking in a whisper so soft I had to lean in to hear. That whispering became his way of talking to me the entire night. Every time I asked him to repeat himself, he grew visibly more irritated. The muscles in his jaw tightened, and his eyes narrowed as if my asking was some kind of insult. I could see the frustration building, and it made me nervous. You don't want to provoke someone already on edge in a place like this. Still, if I couldn't understand him, what was I supposed to do? Later into the shift, when most patients had finally gone quiet, I was making my observation rounds. I had to check every door, every room, making sure everyone was...
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Where they should be. As I passed his doorway, I saw his head poke out slowly, almost like he had been waiting for me again. He whispered something I couldn't make out and gestured toward his room, beckoning me inside. My heart dropped straight into my stomach. I froze, standing there with my clipboard in hand, unsure if stepping into that room was a smart idea. I lingered at the threshold, trying to keep some professional tone, but he noticed the hesitation instantly. He tilted his head, studied my body language, and then his whispering stopped. For the first time all night, he spoke in a normal voice, clear as day. He told me I should come inside and that I didn't need to worry because he wasn't going to hit me. The words hit harder than if he had shouted. Something about the way he said it made my blood run cold. He wasn't joking. He wasn't trying to reassure me. It felt like he was stating a fact, like he knew exactly what I was thinking and wanted me to step just far enough inside that the door could close behind me. Every instinct screamed not to go in, but at the same time, part of the job meant making sure patients weren't in danger, weren't hiding contraband, weren't in distress. So against my better judgment, I stepped in. The room was dim, shadows stretching longer than they should under the single fluorescent bulb. As soon as I was over the threshold, he started to push the door closed behind me. My pulse spiked, and all I could think was how the staff had warned me about him targeting men, how he didn't sleep, how he whispered until he didn't. I kept myself calm on the outside, but inside it was pure panic. My brain kept repeating the same word, trapped. If he decided to attack, no one would hear me over the hum of the hallway lights and the muted sounds of the ward. He stood closer than I was comfortable with, whispering again, asking me questions I could barely hear, gesturing vaguely toward the corner of his room like there was something there he wanted me to see. That's when I noticed the details that made the air feel even heavier. On the floor in the corner he kept motioning to was a worn-out mattress. The sheets were torn, bunched up into strange shapes. It looked almost like he'd been making figures out of them, tying them into knots and arranging them into patterns. On the wall above the mattress were faint scratches, like someone had run their nails across it over and over, carving shallow lines that went nowhere. The whole room gave off this suffocating feeling, like I had stepped out of the hospital and into some place that didn't follow the same rules. My chest tightened, and I remember thinking how absurd it was to feel claustrophobic in a space with one bed, one chair, and four walls. But the silence stretched too long. The whispering turned into words I couldn't quite catch, and for a second, I thought I heard someone else breathing in the room, even though it was just the two of us. He stood there watching me, eyes locked onto mine, whispering so low I couldn't tell if it was my name or something else. The whole time his body blocked the door, and my mind went wild with worst-case scenarios. Eventually I made some excuse, something about needing to finish my rounds, and slipped out before he could react. The rest of that night dragged on forever. Every time I passed his room, I half expected him to be waiting in the doorway again. The whispers seemed to echo in my ears long after I left, like they'd imprinted themselves in the silence of the hallway. I've dealt with plenty of difficult patients before, but something about him felt different, like the danger wasn't just physical. It was the way he watched, the way he whispered, the way his words cut through the quiet when he chose to speak clearly. That was one of the longest nights I've ever had, and I still think about it. I don't know if he really planned to hurt me or if it was all in my head, amplified by nerves and the atmosphere of the unit. Maybe it was just the stress of being there, surrounded by flickering lights and whispered words that never fully formed. Or maybe it was something else entirely, something I can't explain. All I know is that when he said those words, clear and sharp in the middle of the night, I've never felt so certain I was about to become a story told to new staff during their orientation.